It was necessary for me to gain power in some realm into which my parents, my mother particularly, could not follow me. Of course, I did not think about the matter logically. Sometimes I yearned for my mother's love and hated myself for having grieved her. But quite as often I recognized that her love had a high price on it, and that her idea of a good son was a pretty small potato. So I trudged away secretly at the magic. It was card tricks now. I had no trouble getting a pack of cards, for my parents were great players of euchre, and of the several packs in the house I could spirit away the oldest for a couple of hours any afternoon, if I replaced it at the back of the drawer where it was kept, as being too good to throw away, but too slick and supple to use. Having only the one pack, I could not attempt any tricks that needed two cards of the same suit and value. But I mastered a few of those chestnuts in which somebody chooses a card and the conjurer finds it after much shuffling. I even had a beauty involving a silk thread in which the chosen card hopped from the deck as the conjurer stood nonchalantly at a distance. I needed an audience to judge how well I was doing, and I found one readily in Paul Dempster. He was 4 and I was 14. So on the pretext of looking after him for an hour or two, I would take him to the library and entertain him with my tricks. He was not a bad audience, for he sat solemn and mute when he was bidden, chose cards at my command, and if I presented the deck to him with one card slightly protruding while I held the deck tight, that was the card he invariably chose. He had his faults. He could neither read nor count, and so he did not relish the full wonder of it when I produced his card triumphantly after tremendous shufflings, but I knew that I had deceived him and told him so. In fact, my abilities as a teacher had their first airing in that little library, and as I was fond of lecturing, I taught Paul more than I suspected. Of course, he wanted to play too, and it was not easy to explain that I was not playing, but demonstrating a fascinating and involved science. I had to work out a system of rewards, and as he liked stories, I read to him after he had watched me do my tricks. Luckily, we both liked the same book. It was a pretty volume I found in the cupboard of banished books, called A Child's Book of Saints. It was the work of one William Canton, and it began with a conversation between a little girl and her father, which I thought a model of elegant writing. I can quote passages from it still, for I used to read and reread them to Paul, and he, with the memory of a non-reader, could repeat them by heart. Here is one, and I am sure that though I have not read it for 50 years, I have it right. Occasionally these legends brought us to the awful brink of religious controversies and insoluble mysteries. But, like those gentle savages who honor the water spirits by hanging garlands from tree to tree across the river, W.V. was the little girl, could always fling a bridge of flowers over our abysses. "Our sense," she would declare, "is nothing to God's, and though big people have more sense than children, the sense of all the big people in the world put together would be no sense to His. We are only little babies to him. We do not understand him at all." Nothing seemed clearer to her than the reasonableness of one legend which taught that though God always answers our prayers, he does not always answer in the way we would like, but in some better way than we know. "Yes," she observed, "he is just a dear old father." Anything about our Lord engrossed her imagination, and it was a frequent wish of hers that he would come again. Then, poor, perplexed little mortal, whose difficulties one could not even guess at, "we should be quite sure of things. Miss Catherine tells us from books. He would tell us from his memory. People would not be so cruel to him now. Queen Victoria would not allow anyone to crucify him." There was a picture of Queen Victoria hanging in the library, and one look at her would tell you that anybody under her protection was in luck. Thus, for some months I used Paul as a model audience, and paid him off in stories about St. Dorothea and St. Francis, and let him look at the pretty pictures, which were by Heath Robinson. I progressed from cards to coins, which were vastly more difficult. For one thing, I had very few coins, and when my books of instruction said, "Secure and palm 6 half-crowns," I was stopped dead, for I had no half-crowns or anything that looked like them. I had one handsome piece, It was a brass medal that the Linotype Company had prepared to advertise its machines, which my father did not want. And as it was about the size of a silver dollar, I practiced with that. But oh, what clumsy hands I had! I cannot guess how many weeks I worked on the sleight-of-hand pass called the spider. To perform this useful bit of trickery, you nip a coin between your index and little fingers, and then revolve it by drawing the two middle fingers back and forth, in front or behind it. By this means, it is possible to show both sides of the hand without revealing the coin. But just try to do it. Try it with red, knuckly Scots hands, stiffened by grass-cutting and snow-shoveling, and see what skill you develop. Of course, Paul wanted to know what I was doing, and being a teacher at heart, I told him. "Like this?" he asked, taking the coin from me and performing the pass perfectly. I was stunned and humiliated, but looking back on it now, I think I behaved pretty well. "Yes, like that," I said, and though it took me a few days to realize it, that was the moment I became Paul's instructor. He could do anything with his hands. He could shuffle cards without dropping them, which was something I could never be sure of. And he could do marvels with my big brass medal. His hands were small, so that the coin was usually visible. But it was seen to be doing something interesting. He could make it walk over the back of his hand, nipping it between the fingers with a dexterity that left me gasping. There was no sense in envying him. He had the hands, and I had not. And although there were times when I considered killing him, just to rid the world of a precocious nuisance, I could not overlook that fact. The astonishing thing was that he regarded me as his teacher because I could read and tell him what to do. The fact that he could do it did not impress him. He was grateful, and I was in a part of my life where gratitude and admiration, even from such a thing as Paul, were very welcome. If it seems cruel to write "such a thing as Paul," let me explain myself. He was an odd-looking little mortal, with an unusually big head for his frail body. His clothes never seemed to fit him. Many of them were reach-me-downs from Baptist families, and because his mother was so unhandy, they always had holes in them, and were raveled at the edges and ill-buttoned. He had a lot of curly brown hair, because his mother kept begging Amasa Dempster to put off the terrible day when Paul would go to Myron Papel for the usual boy's scalping. His eyes seemed big in his little face, and certainly they were unusually wide apart, and looked dark because his thin skin was so white. My mother was worried about that pallor, and occasionally took charge of Paul and wormed him, a humiliation children did not seem to need any more. Paul was not a village favorite, and the dislike so many people felt for his mother, dislike for the queer and persistently unfortunate, they attached to the unoffending son. 9. My own dislike was kept for Amasa Dempster. A few of his flock said that he walked very closely with God, and it made him spooky. We had family prayers at home, a respectful salute to Providence before breakfast, enough for anybody. But he was likely to drop on his knees at any time and pray with a fervor that seemed indecent. Because I was often around their house, I sometimes stumbled on one of these occasions, and he would motion me to kneel with them until he was finished, which could be as much as 10 or 15 minutes later. Sometimes he mentioned me. I was the stranger within their gates, and I knew he was telling God what a good job I did on the grass and the woodpile. But he usually got in a dig at the end, when he asked God to preserve me from walking with a froward mouth, by which he meant my little jokes to coax a laugh or a smile from his wife. And he never finished without asking God for strength to bear his heavy cross, by which I knew that he meant Mrs. Dempster. She knew it, too. This was the only unkindness he ever offered her. In everything else, he was patient, and so far as his spirit permitted, loving. But before Paul's birth, he had loved her because she was the blood of his heart. Now he seemed to love her on principle. I do not think he knew that he was hinting to God to notice the meek spirit in which he bore his ill luck, but that was the impression his prayers left on my mind. He was no skilled rhetorician, and the poor man had nothing much in the way of brains, so very often what he felt came out more clearly than what he meant to say. His quality of feeling was weighty. I suppose this is what made him acceptable to the Baptists, who valued feeling very highly. much more highly than we Presbyterians, who were scared of it and tried to swap it for intellect. I got the strength of his feeling one awful day when he said to me, "Dunny, come with me to my study in the church. I want a word with you." Wondering what on earth all this solemnity was about, I tagged along with him to the Baptist church, where we went to the tiny parson's room beside the baptismal tank. The first thing he did was drop to his knees and ask God to assist him to be just but not unkind, and then he went to work on me. I had brought corruption into the innocent world of childhood. I had offended against one of God's little ones. I had been the agent, unknowingly, he hoped, by means of which the evil one had trailed his black slime across a pure life. Of course I was frightened. There were boys and girls known to me who made occasional trips to the groves of trees in the old gravel pit that lay to the west of our village and gave themselves up to exploratory pawing. One of these, a Mabel Hayington, was rumored to have gone the limit with more than one boy. But I was not of this group. I was too scared of being found out, and also, I must say in justice to my young self, too fastidious to want the pimply Hayington slut. I preferred my intense, solitary adoration of Leola Cruikshank to such frowsy rough-and-tumble. But all boys used to be open to accusations on matters of sex. Their thoughts alone, to say nothing of half-willing, half-disgusted action, incriminated them before themselves. I thought someone must have given him my name to divert attention from the others. I was wrong. After the preliminary mysterious talk, it came out that he was accusing me of putting playing cards, he called them the devil's picture book, into the hands of his son, Paul. But worse, much worse than that, I had taught the boy to cheat with the cards, to handle them like a smoking car gambler, and also to play deceptive tricks with money. That very morning there had been 3 cents change from the baker's visit, and Paul had picked them up from the table and caused them to vanish. Of course, he had restored them. Utter corruption had not yet set in, and after a beating and much prayer, it had all come out about the cards and what I had taught him. This was bad enough, but worse was to follow. Papistry. I had been telling Paul stories about saints, and if I did not know that the veneration of saints was one of the vilest superstitions of the Scarlet Woman of Rome, he was going to have a word with the Presbyterian minister, the Reverend Andrew Boyer, to make sure I found out. Under conviction of his wickedness, Paul had come out with blasphemous stuff about somebody who had spent his life praying on a pillar 40 feet high, and St. Francis, who saw a living Christ on a crucifix, and St. Mary of the Angels, and more of the same kind, that had made his blood freeze to hear. Now, what was it to be? Would I take the beating I deserved from him, or was he to tell my parents and leave it to them to do their duty? I was a boy of 15 at this time, and I did not propose to take a beating from him, and if my parents beat me, I would run away and become a tramp. So I told him he had better tell my parents. This disconcerted him, for he had been a parson long enough to know that complaints to parents about their children were not always gratefully received. I was bold enough to say that maybe he had better do as he threatened and speak to Mr. Boyer. This was good argument, for our minister was not a man to like advice from Amasa Dempster, and though he would have given me the rough side of his tongue, he would first have eaten the evangelistic Baptist parson without salt. Poor Dempster. He had lost the fight, so he took refuge in banishing me. I was never to set foot in his house again, he said, nor to speak to any of his family, nor dare to come near his son. He would pray for me, he concluded. I left the church in a strange state of mind for a Deptford boy, though I learned later in life that it was common enough. I did not feel I had done wrong, though I had been a fool to forget how dead-set Baptists were against cards. As for the stories about saints, they were tales of wonders, like Arabian Nights. And when the Reverend Andrew Boyer bade all us Presbyterians to prepare ourselves for the marriage feast of the Lamb, it seemed to me that Arabian Nights and the Bible were getting pretty close, and I did not mean this in any scoffing sense. I was most hurt that Dempster had dragged down my conjuring to mere cheating and gambling. It had seemed to me to be a splendid extension of life, a creation of a world of wonder that hurt nobody. All that dim but glittering vision I had formed of Paris, with Robert Houdin doing marvels to delight grand people, had been dragged down by this Deptford parson, who knew nothing of such things and just hated whatever did not belong to life at the $550-a-year level. I wanted a better life than that. But I had been worsted by moral bullying, by Dempster's conviction that he was right and I was wrong, and that gave him an authority over me, based on feeling rather than reason. It was my first encounter with the emotional power of popular morality. In my bitterness, I ill-wished Amasa Dempster. This was a terrible thing to do, and I knew it. In my parents' view of life, superstition was trash for ignorant people. But they had a few reservations, and one was that it was very unlucky to ill-wish anybody. The evil wish would surely rebound upon the wisher. But I ill-wished Dempster. I begged somebody, some god who understood me, that he should be made very sorry for the way he had talked to me. He said nothing to my parents, nor yet to Mr. Boyer. I interpreted his silence as weakness, and probably that was an important element in it. I saw him now a few times each week at a distance, and it seemed to me that the burdens of his life were bearing him down. He did not stoop, but he looked gaunter and crazier. Paul I saw only once, and he turned away from me and ran towards his home, crying. I was terribly sorry for him. But Mrs. Dempster I saw often, for she had intensified her roaming and would spend a whole morning wandering from house to house. Traipsing was the word many of the women now used, offering bunches of wilted rhubarb or some rank lettuce or other stuff from her garden, which was so ill-tended without me that nothing did well in it. But she wanted to give things away and was hurt when neighbors refused these profferings. Her face wore a sweet but woefully un-Deptford expression. It was too clear that she did not know where she was going next, and sometimes she would visit one house 3 times in a morning, to the annoyance of a busy woman who was washing or getting a meal for her husband and sons. When I think of my mother now, I try to remember her as she was in her dealings with Mrs. Dempster. A poor actress, she nevertheless feigned pleasure over the things that were given and always insisted that something be taken in return, usually something big and lasting. She always remembered what Mrs. Dempster had brought and told her how good it had been, though usually it was only fit to be thrown away. "The poor soul dearly loves to give," she said to my father, "and it would be wicked to deny her. The pity is that more people with more to give don't feel the same way." I avoided direct meetings with Mrs. Dempster, for she would say, "Dunstable Ramsay, you've almost grown to be a man. Why don't you come to see us any more? Paul misses you. He tells me so." She had forgotten, or perhaps she never knew, that her husband had warned me away. I never saw her without a pang of guilt and concern about her. But for her husband, I had no pity. 10. Mrs. Dempster's wanderings came to an end on Friday, 24 October, 1913. It was almost 10 o'clock at night, and I was reading by the stove, as was my father. My mother sewed something for the Mission Circle Bazaar, and Willie was at a practice of a youth band a local enthusiast had organized. Willie played the cornet and had his eye on the first flute, one Ada Blake. When the knock came at the door, my father went, and after some quiet muttering asked the callers to come in while he put on his boots. They were Jim Warren, who was our part-time village policeman, and George and Garnet Harper, a couple of practical jokers who on this occasion looked unwontedly solemn. "Mary Dempster's disappeared," my father explained. "Jim's organizing a hunt." "Yep, been gone since after supper," said the policeman. "Reverend come home at 9 and she was gone. Nowhere's round the town, and now we're going to search the pit. If she's not there, we'll have to drag the river." "You'd better go along with your father," said my mother to me. "I'll get right over to Dempster's and keep an eye on Paul, and be ready when you bring her home." Much was implied in that speech. In the instant, my mother had acknowledged me as a man, fit to go on serious business. She had shown also that she knew that I was as concerned about the Dempsters, perhaps, as herself. There had been no questions about why I had not been going there to do the chores for the past few months. I am sure my parents knew Amasa Dempster had warned me away and had assumed that it was part of the crazy pride and self-sufficiency that had been growing on him. But if Mrs. Dempster was lost at night, all daylight considerations must be set aside. There was a good deal of the pioneer left in people in those days, and they knew what was serious. I darted off to get the flashlight. My father had recently bought a car, rather a daring thing in Deptford at that time, and a large flashlight was kept in the toolkit on the running board in case we should be benighted with a flat tire. We made for the pit, where 10 or 12 men were already assembled. I was surprised to see Mr. Mahaffey, our magistrate, among them. He and the policeman were our law, and his presence meant grave public concern. This gravel pit was of unusual importance to our village, because it completely blocked any normal extension of streets or houses on our western side. Thus it was a source of indignation to our village council. However, it belonged to the railway company, which valued it as a source of the gravel they needed for keeping their roadbed in order, and which they excavated and hauled considerable distances up and down the track. How big it was, I do not accurately know, but it was big, and prejudice made it seem bigger. It was not worked consistently, and so was often undisturbed for a year or more at a time. In it there were pools, caused by seepage from the river which it bordered, and a lot of scrub growth, sumac, sallow, Manitoba maple, and such unprofitable things, as well as goldenrod and kindred trashy weeds. Mothers hated it because sometimes little children strayed into it and were hurt, and big children sneaked into it and met the like of Mabel Hayington. But most of all it was disliked because it was a refuge for the tramps who rode the rods of the railway. Some of these were husky young fellows. Others were old men, or men who seemed old, in ragged greatcoats belted with a piece of rope or a strap, wearing hats of terrible dilapidation, and giving off a stench of feet, sweat, feces and urine that would have staggered a goat. They were mighty drinkers of flavoring extracts and liniments that had a heavy alcohol base. All of them were likely to appear at a back door and ask for food. In their eyes was the dazed, stunned look of people who live too much in the open air without eating properly. They were generally given food and generally feared as lawless men. In later life, I have been sometimes praised, sometimes mocked, for my way of pointing out the mythical elements that seem to me to underlie our apparently ordinary lives. Certainly that cast of mind had some of its origin in our pit, which had much the character of a Protestant hell. I was probably the most entranced listener to a sermon the Reverend Andrew Boyer preached about Gehenna, the hateful valley outside the walls of Jerusalem where outcasts lived, and where their flickering fires, seen from the city walls, may have given rise to the idea of a hell of perpetual burning. He liked to make his hearers jump now and then, and he said that our gravel pit was much the same sort of place as Gehenna. My elders thought this far-fetched, but I saw no reason then why hell should not have, so to speak, visible branch establishments throughout the earth, and I have visited quite a few of them since. Under the direction of Jim Warren and Mr. Mahaffey, it was agreed that 15 of us would scramble down into the pit and form a line, leaving 20 or 30 feet between each man, and advance from end to end. Anybody who found a clue was to give a shout. As we searched, there was quite a lot of sound, for I think most of the men wanted any tramps to know we were coming and get out of the way. Nobody liked the idea of coming on a tramp's bivouac. They were called jungles, which made them seem more terrible, unexpectedly. We had seen only 2 fires at the far end of the pit, but there could be quite a group of tramps without a fire. My father was 30 feet on my left, and a big fellow named Ed Haney on my right, as I walked through the pit. In spite of the nearness of the men, it was lonely work, and though there was a moon, it was waning and the light was poor. I was afraid and did not know what I feared, which is the worst kind of fear. We might have gone a quarter of a mile when I came to a clump of sallow. I was about to skirt it when I heard a stirring inside it. I made a sound, I am sure it was not a yell, that brought my father beside me in an instant. He shot the beam of his flashlight into the scrub, and in that bleak, flat light we saw a tramp and a woman in the act of copulation. The tramp rolled over and gaped at us in terror. The woman was Mrs. Dempster. It was Haney who gave a shout, and in no time all the men were with us, and Jim Warren was pointing a pistol at the tramp, ordering him to put his hands up. He repeated the words 2 or 3 times, and then Mrs. Dempster spoke. "You'll have to speak very loudly to him, Mr. Warren," she said. "He's hard of hearing."
I don't think any of us knew where to look when she spoke, pulling her skirts down but remaining on the ground. It was at that moment that the Reverend Amasa Dempster joined us. I had not noticed him when the hunt began, though he must have been there. He behaved with great dignity, leaning forward to help his wife rise with the same sort of protective love I had seen in him the night Paul was born. But he was not able to keep back his question. "Mary, what made you do it?" She looked him honestly in the face and gave the answer that became famous in Deptford.
"He was very civil, Massa, and he wanted it so badly."
He put her arm under his and set out for home, just as if they were going for a walk. Under Mr. Mahaffey's direction, Jim Warren took the tramp off to the lockup. The rest of us dispersed without a word. 11. Dempster visited Mr. Mahaffey early on Saturday and said that he would lay no charge and take part in no trial, so the magistrate took counsel with my father and a few other wise heads and told Jim Warren to get the tramp off the village bounds with a warning never to be seen there again. The real trial would come on Sunday, and everybody knew it. The buzzing and humming were intense all day Saturday, and at church on Sunday everybody who was not a Baptist was aching to know what would happen at the Baptist service. The Reverend Andrew Boyer prayed for all who were distressed in spirit, and especially for a family known to us all who were in sore travail. And something of a similar intention was said in the Anglican and Methodist churches. Only Father Regan at the Catholic Church came out flat-footed and said from his pulpit that the gravel pit was a disgrace and a danger, and that the railway had its nerve not to clean it up or close it up. But when we heard about that, everybody knew it was beside the point. Mrs. Dempster had given her consent. That was the point. Supposing she was a little off her head, how insane had a woman to be before it came to that? Dr. McCausland, appealed to on the steps of our church by some seekers after truth, said that such conduct indicated a degeneration of the brain, which was probably progressive. We soon knew what the Baptist parson said that morning. He went into his pulpit, prayed silently for a short time, and then told his congregation that the time had come for him to resign his charge, as he had other duties that were incapable of being combined with it. He asked for their prayers and went into his study. A prominent member of the congregation, a baker, took charge and turned the service into a meeting. The baker and a few other men were asking the parson to wait a while, but the majority was against them, especially the women. Not that any of the women spoke. They had done their speaking before church, and their husbands knew the price of peace. So at last the baker and one or two others had to go into the study and tell Amasa Dempster that his resignation was accepted. He left the church without any prospects, a crazy and disgraced wife, a delicate child, and $6 in cash. There were several men who wanted to do something for him, but the opinion of their wives made it impossible. There was a terrible quarrel in our household, the more terrible because I had never heard my parents disagree when they knew that Willie and I could hear them. What I heard by way of the stovepipe sometimes amounted to disagreement, but never to a quarrel. My father accused my mother of wanting charity. She replied that as the mother of two boys, she had standards of decency to defend. That was the meat of the quarrel, but before it had gone very far, it reached a point where she said that if he was going to stand up for filthy behavior and adultery, he was a long way from the man she had married, and he was saying that he had never known she had a cruel streak. I could have told him something about that. This battle went on at Sunday dinner, and drove Willie, who was the least demonstrative of fellows, to throw down his napkin and exclaim, "Oh, for the love of the crows!" and leave the table. I dared not follow, and as my parents' wrath grew, I was numbed with misery. Of course, my mother won. If my father had not given in, he would have had to live with outraged female virtue for, perhaps, the rest of his life. As things were, I do not believe that she ever gave up a suspicion that he was not as firm in his moral integrity as she had once believed. Mrs. Dempster had transgressed in a realm where there could be no shades of right and wrong, and the reason she had offered for doing so. That was what stuck in the craws of all the good women of Deptford. Mrs. Dempster had not been raped, as a decent woman would have been. No, She had yielded because a man wanted her. The subject was not one that could be freely discussed even among intimates, but it was understood without saying that if women began to yield for such reasons as that, marriage and society would not last long. Any man who spoke up for Mary Dempster probably believed in free love. Certainly, he associated sex with pleasure, and that put him in a class with filthy thinkers like Cecy Athelstan. Cecil Athelstan, always known as Cecy, was the black sheep of our ruling family. He was a fat, swag-bellied boozer who sat in a chair on the sidewalk outside the Tecumseh House bar when the weather was fine, and on the same chair inside the bar when it was not. Once a month, when he got his check, he went for a night or two to Detroit, across the border, and according to his own account, he was the life and soul of the bawdy houses there. Foul-mouthed bum though he was, he had enough superiority of experience and native wit to hold a small group of loafers in awe, and his remarks, sometimes amusing, were widely quoted, even by people who disapproved of him. Mrs. Dempster's answer was a gift to a man like Cecy. "Hey," he would shout across the street to one of his cronies, "you feeling civil today? I feel so goddamned civil, I got to get to Detroit right away, or maybe just up to you-know-whose." Or as some respectable woman passed on the other side of the street from the hotel, he would sing out, just loud enough to be heard, "I want it. Hey, Cora, I want it so." The strange thing was that the behavior of this licensed fool made the enormity of Mrs. Dempster's words greater, but did not lower the town's esteem of Cecy Athelstan, probably because it could go no lower. At school, there were several boys who pestered me for descriptions with anatomical detail of what I had seen in the pit. I had no trouble silencing them, but of course Cecy and his gang lay beyond my power. It was Cecy, with some of his crowd and the Harper boys, who ought to have known better, who organized the shivery when the Dempsters moved. Amasa Dempster got out of the Baptist parsonage on the Tuesday after his resignation and took his wife and son to a cottage on the road to school. The parsonage had been furnished, so they had little enough to move, but a few people who could not bear to think of them in destitution mustered furniture for the new place without letting it be too clearly known who had done it. I know my father put up some of the money for this project, very much on the quiet. At midnight, a gang with blackened faces beat pans and tooted horns outside the cottage for half an hour, and somebody threw a lighted broom on the roof. But it was a damp night, and no harm was done. Cecy's voice was heard half over the town, shouting, "Come on out, Mary! We want it!" I wish I could record that Amasa Dempster came out and faced them, but he did not. I never saw a man change so much in so short a time. He was gaunt and lonely before, but there had been fire in his eyes. In 2 weeks, he was like a scarecrow. He had a job. George Alcott, who owned the sawmill, offered Dempster a place as a bookkeeper and timekeeper at $12 a week, which was not a bad wage for the work, and in fact made the Dempsters slightly better off than they had been, for there was no church tithe expected out of it. But it was the come-down, the disgrace, that broke Dempster. He had been a parson, which was the work dearest to his heart. Now he was nothing in his own eyes, and clearly he feared the worst for his wife. What passed between them nobody knew, but she was not seen in the village and very rarely in the little yard outside the cottage. There was a rumor that he kept her tied to a long rope inside the house so that she could move freely through it but not get out. On Sunday mornings, her arm in his, she went to the Baptist church, and they sat in a back pew, never speaking to anyone as they came and went. She began to look very strange indeed, and if she was not mad before, people said, she was mad now. I knew better. After a few weeks during which I was miserable because of the village talk, I sneaked over there one day and peeped in a window. She was sitting on a chair by a table, staring at nothing. But when I tapped on the pane, she looked at me and smiled in recognition. In an instant, I was inside, and after a few minutes of uneasiness, we were talking eagerly. She was a little strange because she had been so lonely, but she made good sense, and I had enough gumption to keep on general topics. I soon found out that she knew nothing of what was going on in the world, because the Dempsters took no newspaper. After that, I went there 2 or 3 times a week, with a daily paper or a copy of our own banner, and I read things to her that I knew would interest her and kept her up on the gossip of the town. Often Paul was with us, because he never played with other children, and I did what I could for him. It was well understood that these visits were not to be mentioned to Dempster, for I was sure he still thought me a bad influence. I began this deceitful line of conduct, for my mother would have been furious, and I thought anybody who had seen me going there would have spread the word, hoping I could do something for Mrs. Dempster. But it was not long before I found that she was doing much for me. I do not know how to express it, but she was a wise woman, and though she was only 10 years older than myself, and thus about 26 at this time, she seemed to me to have a breadth of outlook and a clarity of vision that were strange and wonderful. I cannot remember examples that satisfactorily explain what I mean, and I recognize now that it was her lack of fear, of apprehension, of assumption that whatever happened was inevitably going to lead to some worse state of affairs, that astonished and enriched me. She had not been like this when first I knew her, after Paul's birth, but I see now that she had been tending in this direction. When she had seemed to be laughing at things her husband took very seriously, she had been laughing at the disproportion of his seriousness. And of course, in Deptford it was very easy to understand such laughter as the uncomprehending gigglings of a fool. It would be false to suggest that there was anything philosophical in her attitude. Rather, it was religious, and it was impossible to talk to her for long without being aware that she was wholly religious. I do not say deeply religious, because that was what people said about her husband, and apparently they meant that he imposed religion as he understood it on everything he knew or encountered. But she, tied up in a rotten little house without a friend except me, seemed to live in a world of trust that had nothing of the stricken, lifeless, unreal quality of religion about it. She knew she was in disgrace with the world, but did not feel disgraced. She knew she was jeered at, but felt no humiliation. She lived by a light that arose from within. I could not comprehend it, except that it seemed to be somewhat akin to the splendors I found in books, though not in any way bookish. It was as though she were an exile from a world that saw things her way, and though she was sorry Deptford did not understand her, she was not resentful. When you got past her shyness, she had quite positive opinions, but the queerest thing about her was that she had no fear. This was the best of Mary Dempster. Of the disorder and discomfort of that cottage I shall not speak, and though little Paul was loved and cherished by his mother, he was in his appearance a pitifully neglected child. So perhaps she was crazy, in part, but it was only in part. The best side of her brought comfort and assurance into my life, which badly needed it. I got so that I did not notice the rope she wore. It was actually a harness that went around her waist and shoulders, with the horse-smelling hemp rope knotted to a ring on one side so that she could lie down if she wanted to. Or the raggedness of her clothes, or the occasional spells when she was not wholly rational. I regarded her as my greatest friend, and the secret league between us as the taproot that fed my life. Close as we grew, however, there was never any moment when I could have asked her about the tramp. I was trying to forget the spectacle, so horrible in my visions, of what I had seen when I first happened on them, those bare buttocks and 4 legs so strangely opposed. But I could never forget. It was my first encounter with a particular kind of reality, which my religion, my upbringing, and the callowly romantic cast of my mind had declared obscene. Therefore, there was an aspect of Mary Dempster which was outside my ken, and being young and unwilling to recognize that there was anything I did not or could not know, I decided that this unknown aspect must be called madness. 12. The year that followed was a busy one for me, and, except for my visits to Mrs. Dempster, lonely. My school friends accused me of being a know-all, and with characteristic perversity I liked the description. By searching the dictionary, I discovered that a know-all was called, among people who appreciated knowledge and culture, a polymath, and I set to work to become a polymath with the same enthusiasm that I had once labored to be a conjurer. It was much easier work. I simply read the encyclopedia in our village library. It was a Chambers, the 1888 edition, and I was not such a fool as to think I could read it through. I read the articles that appealed to me, and when I found something particularly juicy, I read everything around it that I could find. I beavered away at that encyclopedia with a tenacity that I wish I possessed now. And if I did not become a complete polymath, I certainly gained enough information to be a nuisance to everybody who knew me. I also came to know my father much better, for after the search for Mrs. Dempster in the pit, he put himself out to make a friend of me. He was an intelligent man, and well-educated in an old-fashioned way. He had gone to Dumfries Academy as a boy, and what he knew he could marshal with a precision I have often envied. It was he and he alone who made the study of Latin anything but a penance to me, for he insisted that without Latin nobody could write clear English. Sometimes on our Sunday walks along the railroad track we were joined by Sam West, an electrician with a mind above the limitations of his work. As a boy he had been kept hard at the Bible, and not only could he quote it freely, but there was not a contradiction or an absurdity in it that he did not know and relish. His detestation of religion and churches was absolute, and he scolded about them in language that owed all its bite to the Old Testament. He was unfailingly upright in all his dealings, to show the slaves of priestcraft and superstition that morality has nothing to do with religion. And he was an occasional attendant at all our local churches, in order to wrestle mentally with the sermon and confute it. His imitations of the parsons were finely observed, and he was very good as the Reverend Andrew Boyer. O Lord, take thou a live coal from off thine altar and touch our lips, he would shout, in a caricature of our minister's fine Edinburgh accent. Then, with a howl of laughter, wouldn't he be surprised if his prayer was answered? If he hoped to make an atheist of me, this was where he went wrong. I knew a metaphor when I heard one, and I liked metaphor better than reason. I have known many atheists since Sam, and they all fall down on metaphor. At school, I was a nuisance, for my father was now chairman of our continuation school board, and I affected airs of near equality with the teacher that must have galled her. I wanted to argue about everything, expand everything, and generally turn every class into a Socratic powwow, instead of getting on with the curriculum. Probably I made her nervous, as a pupil full of green fermenting information is so well able to do. I have dealt with innumerable variations of my young self in classrooms since then, and I have mentally apologized for my tiresomeness. My contemporaries were growing up, too. Leola Cruikshank was now a village beauty, and well understood to be Percy Boyd Staunton's girl. Spider Webb still thought me wonderful, and I graciously permitted her to worship me from a distance. Milo Papel had found that a gift for breaking wind was not in itself enough for social success, and he learned a few things from the traveling salesmen who were shaved by his father that gave him quite a new status. It was an era when parodies of popular songs were thought very funny, and when conversation flagged, he would burst into, "I had a dewlap, a big flabby dewlap, and you had a red, red nose." Or perhaps, "I dream of Jeannie with the light brown hair, drunk in the privy in her underwear." These fragments were always very brief, and he counted on his hearers bursting into uncontrollable laughter before they were finished. Nuisance that I was, I used to urge him to continue, for which he very properly hated me. He also had a few pleasantries about smelly feet, which went well at parties. I refused to laugh at them, for I was jealous of anybody who was funnier than I. The trouble was that my jokes tended to be so complicated that nobody laughed but Spider Webb, who obviously did not understand them. The great event of the spring was the revelation that Percy Boyd Staunton and Mabel Hayington had been surprised in the sexual act by Mabel's mother, who had tracked them to Dr. Staunton's barn and pounced. Mrs. Hayington was a small, dirty, hysterical woman whose own chastity was seriously flawed. She had been a grass widow for several years. What she said to Percy's father, whom she insisted on seeing just as he got nicely off into his after-dinner nap one day, was so often repeated by herself on the streets that I heard it more than once. If she thought because she was a poor widow her only daughter could be trampled underfoot by a rich man's son and then flung aside, by Jesus, she would show him different. She had her feelings, like anybody else.
Was she to go to Mr. Mahaffey right then and get the law to work, or was he going to ask her to sit down and talk turkey? What turkey amounted to remained a mystery. Some said $50, and others said $100. Mrs. Hayington never revealed the precise sum. There were those who said that 25 cents would have been a sufficient price for Mabel's virtue, such as it was. She consistently met the brakeman of a freight train that lay on a siding near the gravel pit for half an hour every Friday, and he enjoyed her favors on some sacks in a freight car. She had also had to do with a couple of farmhands who worked over near the Indian reservation. But Dr. Staunton had money, reputedly lots of money, for he had built up substantial land holdings over the years and was doing very well growing tobacco and sugar beet, which was just coming into its own as an important crop. The doctoring was a second string with him, and he kept it up chiefly for the prestige it carried. Still, he was a doctor, and when Mrs. Hayington told him that if there was a baby she would expect him to do something about it, she struck a telling blow. For our village, this amounted to scandal in high society. Mrs. Staunton was elaborately pitied by some of the women. Others blamed her for letting Percy have his own way too much. Some of the men thought Percy a young rip. But the Cessy Athelstan crowd acclaimed him as one of themselves. Ben Cruikshank, a tough little carpenter, stopped Percy on the street and told him if he ever came near Leola again, he would cripple him. Leola wore a stricken face for days, and it was known that she was pining for Percy and forgave him in spite of everything, which made me cynical about women. Some of our more profound moralists harked back to the incident of Mrs. Dempster, and said that if a parson's wife behaved like that, it was no wonder young ones picked up notions. Dr. Staunton kept his own counsel, but it became known that he had decided to send Percy away to school, where he would not have his mother to baby him. And that, headmaster, is how Percy came to be at Colburn College, of which in time he became a distinguished old boy and chairman of the Board of Governors. 13. The autumn of 1914 was remarkable in most places for the outbreak of the war, but in Deptford, my brother Willie's illness ran it close as a subject of interest. Willie had been ill at intervals for 4 years. His trouble began with an accident in the banner plant when he had attempted to take some rollers from the big press, the one used for printing the newspaper, without help. Jumper Saul was absent, pitching for the local baseball team. The rollers were not extremely heavy, but they were awkward, and one of them fell on Willie and knocked him down. At first it seemed that nothing would come of it except a large bruise on his back, but as time wore on, Willie began to have spells of illness marked by severe internal pain. Dr. McCausland could not do much for him. X-ray was unheard of in our part of the world, and the kind of exploratory operations that are so common now were virtually unknown. My parents took Willie to Pittstown a few times to see a chiropractor, but the treatments hurt Willie so much that the chiropractor refused to continue them. Until the autumn of 1914, however, Willie had come round after a few days in bed, with a light diet and a quantity of Sexton Blake stories to help him along. This time he was really very ill, so ill that he had periods of delirium. His most dramatic symptom, however, spoken of around the village in hushed tones, was a stubborn retention of urine that added greatly to his distress. Dr. McCausland sent to Toronto for a specialist, an alarming move in our village, and the specialist had very little to suggest except that immersions in warm water at 4-hour intervals might help. He did not advise an operation yet, for at that time the removal of a kidney was an extremely grave matter. As soon as the news of what the specialist had said got around, we had a group of volunteers to assist with the immersions. These were bound to be troublesome, for we had no bathtub except a portable one, which could be put by the bed, and to which all the warm water had to be carried in pails. I have already said that our village had a kind heart, and practical help of this kind was what it understood best. 6 immersions a day were nothing, in the light of their desire to lend a hand. Even the new Presbyterian minister, the Reverend Donald Phelps, come to replace the Reverend Andrew Boyer, retired in the spring of 1914, was a volunteer, comparative stranger though he was. More astonishing, Cessy Athelstan was one of the group, and was cold sober every time he turned up. Getting Willie through this bad time became a public cause.
The baths certainly seemed to make Willie a little easier, though the swelling caused by the retention of urine grew worse. He had been in bed for more than 2 weeks when the Saturday of our fall fair came and brought special problems with it. My father had to attend. Not only had he to write it up for the banner, but as chairman of our continuation school board, he had to judge 2 or 3 contests. My mother was expected to attend, and wanted to attend, because the ladies' aid of our church was offering a fowl supper, and she was a noted organizer and pusher of fancy victuals. The men who would give Willie his 6 o'clock plunge bath would arrive in plenty of time, but who was to stay with him during the afternoon? I was happy to do so. I would go to the fair after supper, because it always seemed particularly gay and romantic as darkness fell. From 2 until 3, I sat in Willie's room, reading, and between 3 and 1/2 past, I did what I could for Willie while he died. What I could do was little enough. He became restless and hot, so I put a cold towel on his head. He began to twist and moan, so I held his hands and said what I could think of that might encourage him. He ceased to hear me, and his twisting became jerking and convulsion. He cried out 5 or 6 times, not screaming, but spasmodic cries, and in a very few minutes became extremely cold. I wanted to call the doctor, but I dared not leave Willie. I put my ear to his heart. Nothing. I tried to find his pulse. Nothing. Certainly he was not breathing, for I hurried to fetch my mother's hand mirror and hold it over his mouth. It did not cloud. I opened one eye. It was rolled upward in his head. It came upon me that he was dead. It is very easy to say now what I should have done. I can only record what I did do. From the catastrophe of realizing that Willie was dead, it was the psychological equivalent of a house falling inward upon itself, and I can still recall the feeling. I passed quickly into strong revolt. Willie could not be dead. It must not be. I would not have it. And without giving a thought to calling the doctor, whom I had never really liked, though it was the family custom to respect him, I set out on the run to fetch Mrs. Dempster. Why? I don't know why. It was not a matter of reason, not a decision at all. But I can remember running through the hot autumn afternoon, and I can remember hearing the faint music of the merry-go-round as I ran. Nothing was very far away in our village, and I was at the Dempster's cottage in not much more than 3 minutes. Locked, of course. Paul's father would have taken him to the fair. I was through the living-room window, cutting Mrs. Dempster's rope, telling her what I wanted, and dragging her back through the window with me in a muddle of action that I cannot clearly remember at all. I suppose we would have looked an odd pair if there had been anyone to see us, running through the streets hand in hand. And I do remember that she hoisted up her skirts to run, which was a girlish thing no grown woman would ever have done if she had not caught the infection of my emotion. What I do remember was getting back to Willie's room, which was my parents' room, given up to the sick boy because it was the most comfortable, and finding him just as I had left him, white and cold and stiff. Mrs. Dempster looked at him solemnly, but not sadly. Then she knelt by the bed and took his hands in hers and prayed. I had no way of knowing how long she prayed, but it was less than 10 minutes. I could not pray and did not kneel. I gaped and hoped. After a while she raised her head and called him. "Willie," she said in a low, infinitely kind and indeed almost a cheerful tone. Again, "Willie." I hoped till I ached. She shook his hands gently, as if rousing a sleeper. "Willie." Willie sighed and moved his legs a little. I fainted. When I came round, Mrs. Dempster was sitting on Willie's bed, talking quietly and cheerfully to him, and he was replying, weakly but eagerly. I dashed around, fetched a towel to bathe his face, the orange and albumin drink he was allowed in very small quantities, a fan to create a better current of air. Everything there was that might help and give expression to my terrible joy. Quite soon Willie fell asleep, and Mrs. Dempster and I talked in whispers. She was deeply pleased, but, as I now remember it, did not seem particularly surprised by what had happened. I know I babbled like a fool. The passing of time that afternoon was all awry, for it did not seem long to me before the men came to get Willie's 6 o'clock plunge ready, so it must have been 5:30. They were astonished to find her there, but sometimes extraordinary situations impose their own tactful good manners, and nobody said anything to emphasize their first amazement. Willie insisted that she stand by him while he was being plunged, and she helped in the difficult business of drying him off, for he was tender all around his body. Therefore, I suppose it must have been close to 6:30 when my mother and father arrived home, and with them Amasa Dempster. I don't know what sort of scene I expected. Something on biblical lines would have appeared appropriate to me. But instead, Dempster took his wife's arm in his, as I had seen him do it so often, and led her away. As she went, she paused for an instant to blow a kiss to Willie. It was the first time I had ever seen anybody do such a thing, and I thought it a gesture of great beauty. To Willie's everlasting credit, he blew a kiss back again, and I have never seen my mother's face blacker than at that moment. When the Dempsters were gone and the men had been thanked and offered food, which they refused, this was ritual, for only the night plungers at 2 and 6 in the morning thought it right to accept coffee and sandwiches, there was a scene downstairs which was as bad, though not as prolonged, as anything I later experienced in the war. What did I mean by failing to send for Dr. McCausland and my parents at the first sign of danger? What under heaven had possessed me to turn to that woman, who was an insane degenerate, and bring her not only into our house, but to the very bedside of a boy who was dangerously ill? Did all this cynical nonsense I had been talking, and the superior airs I had been assuming, mean that I, too, was going off my head? How did I come to be so thick with Mary Dempster in her present condition? If this was what all my reading led to, it was high time I was put to a job that would straighten the kinks out of me. Most of this was my mother, and she performed variations on these themes until I was heartsick with hearing them. I know now that a lot of her anger arose from self-reproach, because she had been absent, making a great figure of herself in the ladies' aid, when duty should have kept her at Willie's bedside. But she certainly took it out of me, and so, to a lesser degree, did my father, who felt himself bound to back her up, but who plainly did not like it. This would have gone on until we all dropped with exhaustion, I suppose, if Dr. McCausland had not arrived. He had been in the country and had just returned. He brought his own sort of atmosphere, which was cold and chilly and smelled of disinfectant, and took a good look at Willie. Then he questioned me. He catechized me thoroughly about what symptoms Willie had shown and how he had behaved before he died, because I insisted that Willie had, indeed, died. No pulse, no breathing. "But clenched hands?" said Dr. McCausland. "Yes," said I. "But did that mean that Willie could not have been dead?" "Obviously he was not dead," said the doctor. "If he had been dead, I would not have been talking to him a few minutes ago. I think you may safely leave it to me to say when people are dead, Dunny," he continued, with what I am sure he meant as a kindly smile. "It had been a strong convulsion," he told my parents. "The tight clenching of the hands was a part of it, and an unskilled person could not be expected to detect very faint breathing or heartbeat either." He was all reason, all reassurance, and the next day he came early and did an operation on Willie called tapping. He dug a hollow needle into his side and drew off an astonishing quantity of bloody urine. In a week, Willie was up and about. In 4 months, he had somehow lied his way into the Canadian Army. In 1916, he was one of those who disappeared forever in the mud at Saint-Éloi. I wonder if his hands were clenched after death. Later on, I saw more men than I could count die myself, and a surprising number of the corpses I stumbled over or cleared out of the way had clenched hands, though I never took the trouble to write to Dr. McCausland and tell him so. For me, Willie's recall from death is, and will always be, Mrs. Dempster's second miracle. 14. The weeks following were painful and disillusioning. Among my friends, I dropped from the position of polymath to that of a credulous ass who thought that a dangerous lunatic could raise the dead. I should explain that Mrs. Dempster was now thought to be dangerous, not because of any violence on her part, but because fearful people were frightened that if she were to wander away again, some new sexual scandal would come of it. I think they really believed that she would corrupt some innocent youth or bewitch some faithful husband by the unreason of her lust. It was widely accepted that, Even if she could not help it, she was in the grip of unappeasable and indiscriminate desire. Inevitably, it came out that I had been visiting her on the sly, and there was a lot of dirty joking about that. But the best joke of all was that I thought she had brought my brother back to life. The older people took the matter more seriously. Some thought that my known habit of reading a great deal had unseated my reason, and perhaps that dreaded disease, brain fever, supposed to attack students, was not far off. One or two friends suggested to my father that immediate removal from school and a year or two of hard work on a farm might cure me. Dr. McCausland found a chance to have what he called a word with me, the gist of which was that I might become queer if I did not attempt to balance my theoretical knowledge with the kind of common sense that could be learned from, well, for instance, from himself. He hinted that I might become like Elbert Hubbard if I continued in my present course. Elbert Hubbard was a notoriously queer American who thought that work could be a pleasure. Our new minister, the Reverend Donald Phelps, took me on and advised me that it was blasphemous to think that anyone, even someone of unimpeachable character, could restore the dead to life. The age of miracles was past, said he, and I got the impression that he was heartily glad of it. I liked him. He meant it kindly, which McCausland certainly did not. My father talked to me several times in a way that gave me some insight into his own character, for though he was a man of unusual courage as an editor, he was a peace-at-any-pricer at home. I would do best, he thought, to keep my own counsel and not insist on things my mother could not tolerate. I might even have done so if she had been content to let the subject drop, but she was so anxious to root out of my mind any fragment of belief in what I had seen, and to exact from me promises that I would never see Mrs. Dempster again, and furthermore would accept the village's opinion of her, that she kept alluding to it, darkly, or bringing it out for full discussion, usually at meals. It was clear that she now regarded a hint of tenderness toward Mrs. Dempster as disloyalty to herself, and as loyalty was the only kind of love she could bring herself to ask for, she was most passionate when she thought she was being most reasonable. I said very little during these scenes, and she quite rightly interpreted my silence as a refusal to change my mind. She did not know how much I loved her, and how miserable it made me to defy her. But what was I to do? Deep inside myself I knew that to yield and promise what she wanted would be the end of anything that was any good in me. I was not her husband, who could keep his peace in the face of her furious rectitude. I was her son, with a full share of her own Highland temper and granite determination. One day, after a particularly wretched supper, she concluded by demanding that I make a choice between her and that woman. I made a third choice. I had enough money for a railway ticket, and the next day I skipped school, went to the county town, and enlisted. This changed matters considerably. I was nearly 2 years under age, but I was tall and strong and a good liar, and I had no difficulty in being accepted. She wanted to go to the authorities and get me out, but my father put his foot down there. He said he would not permit me to be disgraced by having my mother drag me out of the army. So now she was torn between a fear that I would certainly be shot dead the day after I began training, and a conviction that there was something even darker between Mrs. Dempster and me than she had permitted herself to think. As for my father, he was disgusted with me. He had a poor opinion of soldiers, and as he had run some risks by being pro-Boer in 1901, he had serious doubts about the justice of any war. Feeling about the war in our village was romantic, because it touched us so little. But my father and Mr. Mahaffey were better aware of what went into the making of that war, and could not share the popular feeling. He urged me to reveal my true age and withdraw, but I was pig-headed and spread the news of what I had done as fast as I could. What my elders thought I did not know or care, but I regained some of the position I had lost among my contemporaries. I loafed at school, as became a man waiting his call to more serious things. My friends seemed to think I might disappear at any hour, and whenever I met Milo Papel, which was at least once a day, he would seize my hand and declaim passionately, "Say cuspidor, but not spittoon," which was the barbershop version of a song of the day that began, "Say au revoir, but not goodbye." Girls took a new view of me, and to my delighted surprise, Leola Cruikshank made it clear that she was mine on loan, so to speak. She still pined for Percy Boyd Staunton, but he was away at school and was a bad and irregular letter writer. So Leola thought that a modest romance with a hero in embryo could do no harm, might even be a patriotic duty. She was a delightful girl, pretty, full of sentimental nonsense, and clean about her person. She always smelled of fresh ironing. I saw a great deal of her, persuaded her that a few kisses did not really mean disloyalty to Percy, and paraded her up and down our main street on Saturday nights, wearing my best suit. I had kept away from Mrs. Dempster, partly from obedience and fear, and partly because I could not bear to face her when so many hateful opinions about her were ringing in my ears. I knew, however, that I could not go off to war without saying goodbye, and one afternoon, with great stealth, I reached her cottage and climbed through the window for the last time. She spoke to me as if I had visited her as often as usual, and did not seem greatly surprised by the news that I had joined the army. We had talked a great deal about the war when it first broke out, and she had laughed heartily at the news that two Deptford women who liked to dabble in spiritualism went several times a week to the cemetery to read the latest news from France to their dead mother, sitting on her grave, picnic style. When I had to leave, she kissed me on both cheeks, a thing she had never done before, and said, "There's just one thing to remember. Whatever happens, it does no good to be afraid." So I promised not to be afraid, and may even have been fool enough to think I could keep my promise. In time, my call came. I climbed on the train, proud of my pass to the camp, and waved from the window to my almost weeping mother and my father, whose expression I could not interpret. Leola was in school,